Much. It's supposed to be recording. I had paused it while I was waiting for everybody. So now it's recording. Good reminder. All right. So let me, and as a reminder, this is all found in bonus 3, I believe. There'll be some things I'll share that aren't in the bonus. There'll be things in the bonus that aren't here. So you can go there to go deeper if you want. All right. So let's start sharing. There we go. All right, I'll probably just do a present here. All right, so the Enneagram is very unique. In the world of personality typology, you have three main traditions. You have what's called the empirical tradition, you have the esoteric tradition, and then you have what's called the wisdom tradition. The empirical tradition is everything that's late 19th century research-based psychological models. Myers-Briggs, DISC, Indra, StrengthsFinder, Berkman, you name it. There's dozens of these kinds of methodologies that are almost entirely focused on preferences and behaviors. So I like this. I don't like that. I behave this way. I don't behave that way. Preferences and behaviors. And they are useful and I use them and I'm grateful for them. But I wouldn't say they're really transformational. And the reason is because it's not terribly revealing to you when you learn, like, I prefer focusing on facts rather than thinking about feelings. Like, I already knew that about myself. So I'm glad that this tool told me the thing that I kind of already knew about myself. And I like that. But it has limited utility. But it's really good at scale. So the empirical tradition works great at large corporate contexts. Then you have the esoteric tradition, which is like numerology and astrology, and there's a handful of others that you will find very, very rarely in the corporate world. And the last tradition is known as the wisdom tradition. And the wisdom tradition predates the empirical tradition by thousands of years. The Enneagram is one of the primary kind of archetypes of the wisdom tradition. And the symbol, which you'll see in a moment, the word Enneagram literally means in Greek, nine shape, meaning a nine-pointed shape. So you'll see the shape in a minute. That shape was etched onto a stone in Egypt in about 2500 BC. And the wisdom of this tool has been carried on through teachers, oral tradition for thousands of years. And in the late 70s, started getting written down. And in the 80s and 90s, it started getting introduced into the corporate world. And it primarily shows up as a typology tool, like here are the various types of people. But the thing that you need to know about this is that the origin of it is actually a human transformation tool. And what makes it so different from all the others is that it is deeper. And when I say deeper, what I mean is the Enneagram will reveal to you, if you let it, why you behave the way you do, why you prefer the things that you do, and that why is profoundly operative. It is material. When you understand the why, then you can actually get at transformation. And so a big part of the goal of the Enneagram is to transform. It is to grow and evolve and develop. And as you grow and evolve and develop as a human, you will become a better leader. And I've used this tool to unlock some of the most intractable dysfunction in senior teams I've ever encountered. And just their awareness of their type structure changed the conversations and began to ease the dysfunction, and their functioning went to a whole new level. So this is super powerful, really useful. Let me start here by just framing a little bit of the larger way of understanding the work that I do in coaching. So let's talk about reality for a minute. You know, reality comes at us at trillions of bits of data per second. Right now, you are sensing, your body is sensing the bottom of your foot, but you maybe weren't aware of it in this moment. And the reason is because the human brain can only process about 60 bits of data per second. You might be hearing the air conditioning. You might hear traffic in the distance. These are things that you won't be paying attention to because your brain can only process so much. So if I direct your attention there, then your brain can process it. And so the way that we navigate or manage this incredible discrepancy is, excuse me, hang on a minute. Give me just one second here. Okay, we're back. Sorry. So the way we navigate that is three main perceptual filters. So the first one is, and I call these lenses, you know, the same way that lenses like sunglasses manage light by doing certain things to that light. And so the first thing it does is that it blocks, right? So these lenses will prevent, the internal perceptual filters will simply block out certain information so that you can focus on the thing that you have in front of you. So like I said, you might be sensing the bottom of your foot right now or the chair against your back, but you weren't paying attention to that until I alerted you to it. Your body had blocked it. Your mind had blocked it. And what do we block? Well, we select what we expect, meaning whatever we're focused on, thinking about, worried about, whatever our needs are, we will select that piece of information from all of the available data to us. So how many of you can see the baby in this picture? Oops, sorry, just lost it again. How many of you can see the baby in this picture? Can you see it?
Yeah.
You got it? Okay, good. So some people have a hard time finding the baby. It's in the white space, of course. So the depending on where you are in your life, if you're a young expectant mother and you see this image, you might see the baby first, and the couple standing on the beach is a secondary thought. Whereas if you're later in your life, you might think less about children and more about that vacation with your spouse. And so this is how the brain operates. The exact same information is available to both of us, but I'm going to select different things. So that is blocking. Then you've got bending. This is where I will distort information as a way to make sense of it. And I'll do all of this unconsciously. So here's a picture of a guy in a pink shirt. He's hugging his girlfriend from behind. The funny thing is that that guy has very hairless arms and the woman has very hairy arms. So in point of fact, it's the other way around. So that's like a distortion, right? A metaphor of distortion. So the same thing is true. If I come into the world or into the room of a meeting and I have a general fear or concern that you don't like me, I will begin to detect, read, pick up, and sense the subtle movements you might make that help me realize, oh, this person doesn't like me. May not be true at all, but I will be looking for evidence of not being liked. This is another great example of, here's something that appears like a woman is floating on a beach on a board. Well, it's obviously a flag, so there's a perceptual filter here that's going on. These are simply the kind of, hang on a minute here. Doug looks like he's trying to get back in. There we go. So the last one is we blend. So blending just refers to, we take a bunch of things that are similar and we call them the same. And most often this happens with what I call the expert mind. Let's say I've been in business 25 years and I've been around a number of cycles. And what starts happening is I start developing this belief that, you know, I've been there, I've done that. This looks a lot like something that happened last year. I've seen this picture play out before. I kind of already know how it's going to end. And what happens is we begin to come under this illusion that we have predictive control of whatever's going to happen or come. And as a consequence, we miss the more fundamental reality, which is you can never step in the same river twice. It is impossible. And so the more we're aware and conscious of the fact that we are bending, blending, and bending all of the data and information that's coming at us in order to create a particular expression of reality. I call this selective compression. This is a technical term that people who are model builders, whenever you model something, you have to employ selective compression. So that means, let's say I've got I want to build a model airplane. Well, am I going to put seatbelts in the seats of this 1/100 scale? Am I going to put all the dials on the dashboard, or am I going to aggregate some of those dials so there's fewer dials? It's just less detail. It's a low res expression or experience of reality. So all of us at all times are unconsciously creating selective compression, and it creates a kind of picture in our mind that we then project out into the world. So this perception automatically becomes a kind of projection. So whatever we think we're seeing out there is actually a projection from our own perceptual filters. And that's not a problem. Go through life living that way, it's no big deal, until you meet somebody else who has a different arrangement in their mind. And when they project it out, You have one of two options. You're either getting conflict or creativity. You're getting somebody who views the world differently than you, and that has the potential for conflict or creativity. So this is the operating assumption that I bring to all coaching work, that all of us, including me, bring to the conversation. And what I'm after is always, how much of reality are my clients in touch with? How much of reality have they limited themselves because of their own expertise, or because of their own fears or anxieties, or because of their own anger and emotion, whatever that is that has effectively limited. And by the way, intense negative emotions create greater restriction and less mobility around what you can see. So the more angry, overwhelmed, exhausted, frightened you become, the less capable we will be of seeing more options in our world. And the reason you want to see more of reality is because it opens more pathways to the potential future that you want to have. Making sense to everybody?
Yes.
Great. All right. Let's jump into the Enneagram then. The Enneagram basically shows you the 9 most common patterns that people tend to create in their own perceptual filters. These are the biases. So I take all the chaos and complexity and I use the Enneagram to create simplicity. So in a very real sense, the Enneagram is merging. It's taking things that are similar and calling them the same. But we do so on purpose, right? The goal is not to get rid of your perceptual filters. That is an impossibility. That wouldn't serve you anyway. Perceptual filters are what help you navigate immense amounts of reality. So first thing you need to know about the Enneagram is that the goal is actually transformation, not just to type yourself and figure out what you are. It's actually to bring more resources into your being so that you can make better decisions. And they talk about 2 parts. The tradition basically would say you have an essence. This is a gift you were born with. You didn't have to earn it. It was given to you. That's like one diamond at the center of your being, and you've always been good at that. And you always will be good at that. Then you have this other piece of element that is called the personality that grows around the gift. And the personality is like coal. And over time and effort and tension and pressure, you can turn that personality into a second diamond. What that means is that your greatest weakness can become your greatest strength in Enneagram tradition. So one is a gift that you were given, the other is earned or learned, and you have twin diamonds at the center of your being that can happen over a lifetime of growing and developing. Or you can ignore the developing and growing and keep the coal around the diamond, and you at least get one diamond. So that's the way this stuff goes. Now, keep in mind, my interest here is not to tell you this is reality. My interest here is to say, I want you to try on this lens. The lens is the Enneagram. Don't believe anything I say. Don't take it as dogma. Take it as, is this instructive? Does this open new things for me? The same way that you might look at through a lens that is yellow versus red, and you'll see different things about the world. So the other distinction that I want to make is the distinction between high and low functioning. Here's the thing about humans. We all have high and low functioning moments. So a high functioning moment is what happens when we're open and balanced and stable and able to handle the stress and obstacles with ease, and we're better able to get what it is we want. That's a high functioning moment. Low functioning moment is the opposite. So when we're closed, reactive, troubled, emotionally stuck, unable to handle stress and obstacles, and can't get what we want. And the goal would be that we have generally more high-functioning moments in our life than low-functioning moments. But no matter how long we've been developing as a human, there will likely be moments of low-functioning, likely be moments of flooded emotions, and you can't do a high-functioning moment. So on the Enneagram, what it shows you is, here's what it looks like for a particular type to be at a low functioning state. And here's what it looks like when they're at a high functioning state. And that gives you a developmental perspective, not just the typology. So you can't just say, well, all 8s are this way and all 3s are this way. You'd say, well, if you're a high functioning 3, you're gonna have more of this. Third thing to be aware of is to think in 3s. So there are 9 types on the Enneagram. And the 9 types are derived from 3 centers of intelligence: the head, the heart, and the gut, or the body. All 3 of these are like a brain. They're a center of intelligence. The head apprehends information and knowledge about the world through rationality. The heart does so through so feeling through feelings, and the body does so through instincts. So the body is full of trillions of intelligent cells that are acting on your behalf without any of us knowing it. We couldn't even direct the body to do the vast majority of the things that it's doing on our behalf. And it carries with it its own intelligence and wisdom. The heart has 40,000 neural dendrites in it. Those are brain cells that are actually found in the heart, the organ of the heart. There is an electromagnetic field of the heart that is 5,000 times greater than that of the brain. So there's something happening in each of these places that guides our navigation through life. And understanding and becoming aware of this can be really, really helpful when you're guiding and leading others. So what this means is when you plot the types, and by the way, the types don't have names. You'll read books, you can go online, there'll people that try to name the types. Names are fine, but all they do is numbers 1 through 9. And they're deliberately numbers so that you don't put too much value to it. And that sounds funny because numbers are value. But the point is that if I said number 2 is a helper and you're like, well, I don't relate to that, you've missed the point. The point isn't the name. The point is what the energy is that represents a 2. So there are 3 body types, means 3 types that have their body or their gut as their primary center of intelligence, 3 heart types, and 3 head types. And when I say it is their primary center of intelligence, I do not mean it is their strongest center. What I mean is it is the center of intelligence around which you have the most distortion. You have the most friction, static, difficulty with that center. So we'll get into what that looks like in a minute. In the simplest way, each number relates differently to their body. So an 8 might feel expressive of their gut instinct. A 9 might live in denial of their gut instinct. And a 1 will tend to repress their gut instinct. And so that's how you get unique differences among 3 body types, because they express and wrestle with that center uniquely. And that goes for the same for all 9 of them. So these are the names that people often give. They're not the only names, but they're just some examples. And what I'm going to do now is I'm just going to walk around the circle a few times, giving you a few different examples so that you can see what the system is. And in the middle is the 9-pointed shape. We'll talk very briefly about that shape at the end and why the lines are the way they are. But 1 is a perfectionist. 2 is a helper. 3 is an achiever. 4 is an artist. 5 we call the observer, 6 is a loyalist, 7 is an enthusiast, 8 is a challenger, and 9 is a mediator. Now let's put a little finer point on all these. When we think about their fundamental needs, their underlying needs, 1s live with a basic underlying need to pursue or be perfect, to pursue perfection. They're very exacting. 2s have an underlying need to be needed. 3s have a fundamental need to be successful and to be seen as successful. 4s need to be special, unique, different. 5s have a need to perceive, to understand, to penetrate beneath the layers of things. 6s have a need for security. 7s have a need to avoid pain at all cost. 8s have a need to be against. They're challengers. And a 9 has a need to avoid conflict. Now, all of these things exist in all of us. It's not as if you're a 1 type and therefore you only have 1 thing. We all have all 3 centers of intelligence, so we all have elements of all of these. But 1 of these things tends to be the driver. Let's look at another example, self-image. When they're at their best, the thing they're pursuing, what they're after, you know, and this is critical, right? When you understand the goal state of a 1 and the goal state of a 6, and they're fundamentally different goal states that are driving the decisions they're making, you can see why they might have different perceptual filters and why that might create conflict and why they're motivated by fundamentally different things than you might be. So the 1 is they're at their best when they were right, when they did it right. Being right is important. 2 is at their best when they were helpful, when they felt like they did something helpful, they win. 3 is when they're successful. 4 is when they've demonstrated total uniqueness. 5 is when they see through things. 6 is when they do their duty. 7 is when they feel happy. 8 is when they've demonstrated strength and power. And nine is when they've found contentment. So you start to see how different that is. Like, if I'm after being right and I'm hanging out with a seven who just cares about having a good time and being happy, these are two different objectives. We're after totally different things. I'm going to hammer through these because I want to get to the metaphors, because the metaphors are probably the most helpful for people. So let me go to this one, the metaphors. So I don't want you to take any of these metaphors too seriously. Like, they're meant to sketch, for lack of a better word, a kind of energetic thumbprint. So I've worked with the Enneagram for almost 20 years. And over those 20 years, what I've learned is that people can take a test and find out their type. They can talk to me and try to find out their type. But their type is ultimately kind of born in the neural networks of their body and their being. There's a kind of an energy that kicks off of them that just is palpable. And it's no different than, like, if you ever watch somebody enter a room and you go, that person fills the room. And they light up the room. You're talking about their energy, that kind of intangible thing. Or like somebody walks in, you're like, wow, that person has like gravitas. They have heaviness. They have weight to them. That's an energetic thumbprint. So that's kind of what I'm talking about here. So let me use these metaphors. Try to have fun with them. Don't take them too seriously if you're one of these types. My goal is to be insulting. So if you're feeling insulted, mm-hmm. I won. So the one is the ant. An ant has this incredible ability to carry 10 times its weight, and they're incredibly, incredibly industrious. Pretty sure ants don't take vacations, and if they do, they're working on them. So if a one were to come to you and say, I'm overworked, believe them. They really, really are overworked. If a seven comes to you and says they're overworked, you can say that's adorable. We'll get into that in a minute. You'll see why. In addition to being an ant, they're also a bee, which is kind of redundant. I know. Worker bees, they just work incessantly. But also they create these incredible geometric patterns and all kinds of structural integrity. So you get a lot of like engineers, accountants, things like that. Those professions draw one energy and require one energy. The one also has a stinger. Ones are actually very critical. They're critical first of themselves and then of everybody else. And so occasionally they can sting, but they'll try to do it very appropriately because there's a right and a wrong way to do this in their own mind. And so they can be quite critical and they can be on rails. So once they've decided this is the way something's going to happen, they get on rails and you're not moving them off. they are very committed to their course of action, and they're devoted to that rightness. So that's the one energy. The two. This is the donkey, the beast of burden. You can load a donkey up and load it up some more, and it'll be grateful for it because it just wants to be helpful. This is different than a one in that the one's motivation is mandate. It's what the abstract sky calls for me to go do, whereas a two does it relationally. I need to feel that I am helping you. So if a two comes to you and says, I'm super overworked, and you say, oh, I'm so sorry, let me take that and give that over there to Jeff. That would be heartbreaking. The proper response for a two is, you're overworked. Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. Thank you so much for everything you do. I don't know what I would do without you. And they'll go, what else can I take on? So instead of being devastated, they'll just be like, great, finally, I got the acknowledgement, okay? So as a result, they're also kind of the cat. The cat is a very interesting creature in that it can be quite ingratiating, and it can sit in your lap and purr and be warm and cuddly and friendly. And all of a sudden it can just like scratch you and bolt out of the next room. And so the twos, if they're feeling unrecognized or unseen, they kind of get into the, no, that's fine. What do I care? I'm fine. I don't need anything. Nope. And they get very cold and prickly and distant. And so that's kind of the dynamic of the two. Are you guys seeing, do you know anybody in your life that maybe reflect these two types? Could be a relative, could be a coworker.
I think here, I am definitely sitting somewhere in a one or a two, but I'm a one based on what you've described and maybe okay. Leaning towards two. So, yep.
Good. Good awareness. Excellent. So at the heart of the Enneagram is the awareness that you have a one primary type. And then you will have access to what are called wings. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But a wing is you also have the resources of the type on either side of you.
So it could be that you're a one with a two wing or a two with a one wing. And as we go around and finish, you'll get a better feel for which kind of collection of types you feel most drawn to. The three is the chameleon. The chameleon is that creature you can put in a green room and it'll turn green. And then you put it in a blue room, it turns blue. It doesn't even know that it does it. It's highly adaptable. So that's one of the primary traits of a three. They're also a little bit of a peacock. Now, not all threes show up this way, but they don't mind being noticed for their achievements. They like to be seen a little bit. So they kind of do that like humble brags every once in a while, maybe some name dropping, you came in, you saw me throwing out my award. I didn't mean for you to see my award that I just got. So they can kind of do that. But they're also unbelievably productive. They produce a tremendous amount in their life. And most of life gets reduced to kind of just a checklist of things to do in the least amount of time. So they're very, very time conscious. Now, ones and threes can look similar, but there's a really big difference. Ones are very adaptable. I mean, our threes are very adaptable. Ones tend to be more rigid. Threes have a tendency to want to kind of find creative, efficient ways to get things done. Ones care less about efficiency and more about doing it right, whatever the right way is. And threes are way more into social monitoring. They're sensing, they have interpersonal antenna going off, going, how am I showing up? How am I being perceived? How is somebody seeing me in this context? Whereas ones are like, well, this is just who I am. And you better kind of deal with that. So classic example, and forgive me, forget politics for a moment, but like Bernie Sanders is a classic one. He's got this energy that's just like, this is who I am. This is what I want. This is what's right. That's not right. He's critical, but he's not a jerk, right? He's just like, that's how he is. Bill Clinton, classic three, just a little bit kind of bob and weave. It depends on what the definition is. Now, again, there are lots of very high functioning threes. So if you hate either of those characters, the goal is not to compare you to that, right? There are really high functioning and there's really low functioning. Tom Hanks is also a three, like a beloved character, right? Always, everybody likes him no matter what. The four is the Basset Hound. Very forlorn, very sad looking. But they're very kind of internal and connected to their own emotional life, need to be totally original, but they're also the oyster, that shell that uses that little sand irritant to create beauty out of pain and suffering. So fours, they'll tend to show up, they'll dress unique, they'll act unique. They don't want to be like everybody else. Fives, you won't find a lot of fives in the corporate world unless you're in a really profoundly difficult problem-solving space. So I'm working with a robotics company that has a huge number of fives because they're all from MIT doing AI and machine learning. So the five is the chipmunk that is constantly stuffing its face full of nuts so that it can store up for the winter. And the way the five experiences this is knowledge. They're constantly gathering more knowledge, more information. And their approach to that knowledge and information is ready, aim, 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 and then go ahead and aim again. And so those that need to get things done can find fives very irritating because they just slow the whole process way down. They want to make sure we've asked the right question in the right way. Have we really gathered the data? Do we understand this? So that's the five. Now, they also happen to be the owl. Sorry, that went too fast. But the owl is the one that can see in the dark and can see in 360. So you want fives in the room if you have them. You just want to make sure you get them to action because they will see things very few others can see. Six is the rabbit, always scanning for a threat. And the wolf. They're pack animals. They care about the pack and they have a complex relationship to authority. So they like alphas, they want alphas, but they don't trust alphas. So they're like, I need a boss, I trust a boss, but I don't trust that you know what I know. And so there's this weird relationship with authority and they're all about keeping things safe. They're constantly worst case scenario planning. So they're the ones that are generally see the world through a pretty negative lens. And they're expert problem solvers, really good at solving problems. Seven is the butterfly. This beautiful magical creature that comes into the room and no matter what's going on, there's magic. You're just, everything's lifted and it's lighter and you're happier. But don't ever mistake this creature for a kite. No strings attached. The seven needs total freedom. They come in, they can create magic and then they're going to get out of there. And that's because they're also the orangutan, the monkey. That creature that swings from tree to tree to tree to tree. It's the stone you skip across the pond, mile wide, inch deep. They have a tendency to pursue pleasure and joy. That's what they're after. And they have a hard time staying in the moment. So they tend to be ideating massively, tons of new, fresh, clear ideas, but less diligence, less interested in diligence. So you get a 7 and a 1 in the same room, and we're going to have a budget meeting for 6 hours. The 1's going to be like, let's get down to business and get going. And the 7 is like, let's not do this ever. So there's a natural clash there. The 8 is the rhino. Now, when a rhino walks into a room and steps on a wine glass and it shatters, do you think that that rhino even noticed that there was a wine glass? Probably not. They have incredibly thick skin and a giant horn on the front, and they're made for charging. They tend to be quite shocked when other people are injured by their charge. So I remember I had a meeting once with an 8, and I'd heard that a conversation this 8 had with a 2 went very badly. I heard it from the 2. It was terrible. Sat down with the 8 and I said, hey, so I understand you had kind of a tough meeting with this other person. And he was like, no, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm like, well, tell me what happened. He's like, oh, I said this, I thought this about that, told him what I thought. He told me what he thought and went our separate ways. That was pretty much what happened. I go talk to the 2. I'm like, sounds like it wasn't a big deal. And the 2's like, I don't ever want to speak to that person again. And I have to go back and negotiate with the 8, like, okay, you've got a big horn on your head that you don't notice, and you're goring people left and right. And so that is at the heart of the 8, this challenging, big, powerful, magnanimous often leaders. But to balance them out, they're also a bull. So maybe not so much balance. The bull is, the only difference there is the bull, when it sees red, it goes, it gets angry. So 8s have a tendency to live with kind of a low-grade anger, irritation, frustration. When an 8 is not doing well, everyone around them are just a bunch of idiots. They have a hard time seeing things that are good. And they also feel like the world is kind of broken and they're the ones who can fix it. And they're probably right. The motto of the 8 is, I have a wonderful plan for your life. They really do see things better than most. They have the ability to take on things that very few others can take on. They're plugged into a nuclear power plant. Donald Trump is an 8, but so is Martin Luther King Jr., right? So that's a great depiction of the two extremes of personality type when you're more low functioning or high functioning, and how you use that extraordinary power. 8s have to learn to do so responsibly. And then the last one is the 9. The 9 is the sloth. Sloth does not mean lazy. It means it appears very slow moving. 9s can be extremely high achieving, but also the whale. Whales are these big, beautiful, gentle creatures that just sort of float freely in the ocean. They're quite magical if you've ever encountered them in the wild. And that's the 9. They're just harmonious and easygoing and flowing and free and kind. But they don't often tell their face what's really going on inside. So I'll be talking to a 9 CEO and he'll have, you know, $300 million of liability on his books, and he'll have a deal that might cause him to have more liquidity and all these things that are going on. And, you know, I'll be talking to him and I'll be like, yeah, I'm pretty stressed out about everything that's going on. I mean, you know, who knows what's going to happen? And I'm like, really? You're stressed out? You should tell your face because, like, you seem so relaxed. And so people are often surprised at how much turmoil they're dealing with, but how at ease everything is. So I'm going to pause there for a minute. I know that was a ton of information, and you don't have to know all this information, but I want you to start being aware of and noticing where you might show up. So the question I have for each of you is, do you sense any resonance with any of these?
Sure.
Mark, where do you live, do you think, most?
Well, I'm curious, based on your where I think I live, what I think I see versus what everybody else sees. 8 and a 6 is kind of, I think I do have the horn.
Yeah.
And always looking for, you know, maybe the rabbit, a combination of the rabbit and the wolf. See through things. always on alert for what's next, you know, and can solve problems pretty good. But also, I'm very direct. I think you said, I have a plan for your life.
Yes.
Yeah.
So let me ask you a couple of questions, if that's all right. So they're lookalike types, right? Certain types look the same. They act the same in many cases, but their underlying motivation is actually quite different. So let me tell you a slight distinction. I'm going to make it extreme, right? So you might have a little bit of both, but I'm going to make it extreme and you tell me which one you tend towards. One type tends to live in a state of things bad happening in the future as if they're currently happening. Meaning when you talk to this type, they will tell you, it's like being on a really terrifying roller coaster ride. They live the fear. They feel the fear. It's very driving. They're no stranger to fear and anxiety. It's a natural state for this type. Whereas the other type, yeah, we all have anxiety. We all feel fear sometimes. Mm-hmm. But anxiety isn't the driving force. The driving force is more like irritation, anger, frustration. So the underlying emotion of one type tends to be more angry. It can be a low-grade anger. Could be a minor irritation, could be frustration, but the first go-to negative emotion is going to be more anger, whereas the other one's first go-to emotion is going to be more panic, fear, anxiety. Both are highly mobilized to action. Both are very direct. Both can be very argumentative, but one is really being governed by a slightly different emotional energy. Which one do you feel like might relate more to you?
Well, it's when you're saying that, I'm just thinking through maybe over the past 8 months, I'm probably, you know, I've had, you know, panic situations where it was like, or, you know, not like, you know, where you feel the panic, like, okay, something's got to happen here, but that it's not consistent. So I don't know if that's episodic or if it's a personality thing. I wouldn't say I'm here. It's the same thing with the irritation, you know. Maybe I get there quickly, so maybe that is a thing. But for the most part, optimistic, enthusiastic. But if something breaks down, I think the first reaction is these guys on the call are going, God, I'd hate to work for you. Is anger or frustration, okay. And I'm poignant with it.
Yeah. Have you ever had the experience of being surprised at how somebody heard you at any time in your life? You know, the experience of like, that's weird. I was just saying this, but they took it this way. Have you ever had that where people take things in ways you don't intend?
Not really.
Okay.
I think when I'm pointing it, they know what I'm.
I mean, have you ever felt like people have experienced you as harder then you've meant something?
No, I think more so, just talking openly here, I don't get that type of feedback, but I get a sense of guilt because I think I was too hard on it.
Got it. Okay.
So yeah. Either I'm too hard on them and they're not willing to give me the feedback or, you know, something like that. I don't know. This is very curious to me.
Yeah, good. Well, these are the right questions to be asking. And I can't remember, are you married or partnered in some
married.
Way?
Yeah, okay. Married.
How long have you been married for?
29 years, I think.
Okay. Is there a particular, you don't have to share this if you don't want, but is there a particular complaint that your wife would say about you? Like sometimes Mark is 2X. Is there a sometimes spouses can be really good mirrors.
I work a lot.
Yeah.
I don't know. After 28 years, maybe I'm just not paying attention to it anymore. Neither is she. But
yeah.
So I guess in the earlier days, it was, you know, it's. I see it more for my kids, like. You know, oh, it's a dad moment right now. And it's not out of frustration. It's out of a lecture or a coaching or whatever. So I don't know. That's the only thing that's kind of hitting me right now.
Yeah, wow. Sure. So to be clear, after a lot of years of living life, our type structure can soften a little bit. And so sometimes you can also ask the question, what was I like when I was 23? You know, was I more like the anxious six? Was I more like the hard charging eight? So the six is the one that's governed primarily. The underlying emotion is actually fear. And when I say underlying, I mean, it's there, and sixes feel it very directly.
Yeah.
Whereas like a three, the underlying emotion is shame, but the threes will never feel it. They're out of touch with it completely. So the six and the eight are actually quite present to their emotions. They're not usually curious. When you talk to a three, they're like, I have no idea what I'm feeling. Nine, they have no idea what they're feeling. But an eight and a six, very present to their emotions. Four, six, and eight are very connected to their emotions and have a tendency to express those emotions.
Yeah, I would live in that. I would live in that. And I would think, you know, if you call it an undertone, it probably is fear. Or some type of, just call it fear. I mean, that's what it is. It's, you know, of not being able to do what I'm thinking I should do, and or this isn't going to work out, or that isn't going to work out. But I'm not, and maybe it's an undertone. I don't consider myself pessimistic, but again, I'd like to see what everybody sees. You know, it might be that.
So it's not critical that you get the answer right now, but it is useful for you and I, as we keep working together, for me to have some shorthand. And so I can cut really quickly to issues to help you. Right. One of which I would say, my experience of you energetically is more like an eight than a six, but I've got limited experience of you, right? So I could be wrong about that. The best thing you can do, if you find this work useful and interesting, is there's a couple of books that are recommended in the download and the bonus. There's a few resources. You can also take a test online, and there's some resources there that I recommend. You can take free tests and take a couple and see where you net out, right? And it may surprise you. It may be one of those, maybe something else. And what we can do is periodically workshop it and just check in and go, okay, these two are similar for this reason. They're different for this reason. And that's what you need to know. Eights and ones look similar. Eights and threes look similar. Eights and sixes look similar. They act similar, but they have fundamentally underlying different motivations. No. So the thing for you to become more awake to, and by the way, this is for everybody on this call, not just Mark, but thing to become more awake to is, am I paying attention to my level of intensity? Because that's the other big thing about an eight, is that they're high bandwidth people. And that means that they live at a super high level of intensity. And people around them feel that intensity. It's not always anger. You know, I use anger as kind of a placeholder. Sometimes intensity isn't anger, it's just intensity. You just plugged into a nuclear power plant and you notice that you can do more and achieve more than the guy next to you or the girl next to you. You just have more access to more gears. That's also pretty typical of an eight. So, you know, the six in most people are worst case scenario planners. They are almost always thinking, what could go wrong? What could go wrong? What could go wrong? And they're almost always viewed as pessimists. So that isn't the sense that I get of you. I get a sense of intensity and clarity, which are two things that are very much a part of eight.
So that, what I was going to ask, and this might be helpful for everybody else, is, I mean, is this self-assessed? Or like you said, I know there's some free tests and whatever. Is there, because I would like to do it on my entire leadership team, my entire staff. I mean,
yeah. What typically happens is, like, when I do this for companies, like I do a day-long training, and I stress for people that this is ultimately yours to decide what you are. And a test can give you a good indication, but you want to be looking at the descriptions and see, does this feel like me or not? And what I'd recommend is, there are a couple of great books. Pick up one of those books, read through a couple of key types you think you might be, and just see if it resonates with you. You know, and if as you're looking at it, you're like, oh my gosh, they're definitely reading my mail, you probably got your type. And the one rule about doing this in a group is that you publicly aren't supposed to type others. You are supposed to type yourself in front of others. And that's where the game can change. So if I were with you on a team and I were like, Mark, stop being such an eight, that's not an okay way to treat this. It's very exposing. But if I said to you, Mark, my three is really active. I'm coming out right now and you're probably getting some of this from me. My apologies, but let me play this out a little bit. Now I've flagged for you. I'm coming from this lens and I acknowledge I see the lens. You acknowledge I see the lens. And now you have both compassion and humor, and all kinds of new things can open up when that happens. Let me pause on you, Mark. Let me go to Doug.
How you doing? I'll tell you, listening to you go through these really reinforces for myself something that you and I had talked about before the call. And that is the self-awareness piece, the ability to understand more about who you are. I listened to you go through this and I can see parts of myself as 1, 3, 5, and 8 are the primary ones. I really have very little 9, very little 7, not much 6 at all in me. And so I definitely want to dig deeper into this and try to get a better feel for where I really do fall. I have a feeling I might be very much in the 8 because I definitely will go through things with somebody and they might be even upset. And I'll be like, why? I'm not upset with you. I'll catch it and hopefully we can work through it. But it's definitely interesting, and I'm definitely getting a good feeling of that. I want to look deeper into this and get a better understanding of who I really am.
Yeah. So I'd say let me put a couple of resources here in the chat for you guys while we're sitting here, so that you can, and maybe just copy these out and let me see if I can find a couple of, probably the best one. There are free ones, but I'll give you the best paid one. All right, here it is. And there's two different levels. You can get what's called a professional level, or you can get a individual level test, whatever you want. And I definitely trust these guys and their ability to assess people. I don't like most Enneagram tests, but this one I do like. You can always go get a free one if you want. And then, you know, feel free to shoot me a message, send me your results. Send me an email with the results once you get them. And that way I'll know, like, as we're talking, I can use this to help you guys further refine the type structure. And it does become really, really helpful. So what I would do is I'd normally have my entire leadership team take it first. So Mark, if you're wanting to do this through your company, this is hard to do at scale, but it's absolutely worth doing with your senior most players first, getting them familiar with the language, how it works, what it is, what it isn't. And then you can cascade it down if you want. But that's how I'd recommend that. So, and then was there something?
Yeah, getting that feel of how to use that within a team is very useful.
Yeah, I mean, the starting point for using it on a team is really gentle awareness, honestly. And that's where I wanted to go a little bit to kind of close out some of the Enneagram presentation part. Then we can talk about you guys. At the heart of transformation using the Enneagram is awareness. Awareness is like light. Light, when you enter a room that is dark and you try to navigate it in the darkness, you're going to knock some things over and hurt yourself. The moment you turn on the light and it reveals all the things in the room and all their places, whether it's in disarray or colors you like or don't, the light has no judgment. The light makes no judgment about what it sees. It merely allows you to make choice, to have choices. That's it. I can choose to walk into the desk or I can walk around the desk. I have a choice. And in my experience doing this for 20 years, the moment someone becomes aware without judging what they see, that's critical, no judgment, non-judging awareness, a wiser part of them takes over and the choice is made as easily as the choice to walk around a table instead of into a table. And where I see leaders repeatedly hitting the table is when they're either judging what they see about themselves or simply can't see it. And the reason the judgment works the same way is because judgment is like turning the light out. If I don't like my face and I'm hate what I look like, how often am I going to be staring in the mirror? I'm going to avoid mirrors like the plague. But if I ask you to study the back of your hand and you have no feelings about the back of your hand, it's very easy to study it. So judgment causes us to hide things from ourselves. So that's why it's so critical that you remove judgment, become curious, and develop awareness. And the more you have that gentle awareness, the more transformation will automatically happen for you. And so that's why when you're introducing to a team, all you're doing is asking questions. Like, what's this like? I believe in the bonus, there's a 9-page summary. Each type is summarized, strengths and weaknesses, how to get along with me, and reflection questions. So if you know you're going to deal with a three, you have a cheat sheet, you can look at it and be like, how do I want to get along with a three? What seems to matter to them that I don't even care about or think about? And then at the bottom is questions for reflection. If you're this type, here are the questions you should be asking yourself each day. Put those questions on your computer, on your desk somewhere where you can just periodically look over at it. And what that's doing is it's like looking in a mirror without even working, without even efforting. You will begin to see shifting take place.
That's in the booklet you said for this one?
Yeah, so if you go to the bonus of the Enneagram, somewhere in there, I can't remember where, but there is a 9-page summary.
Download. Yeah, okay, yeah.
PDF download, and that also has a couple of books I recommend. And here's the thing to be aware of the books. It's probably good to get 2 books. And the reason is because so much of this is about language. When I first learned my type, there was one book I read and I'm like, that's not my type at all because of the words they used. And then I read a different book and I thought they were reading my journal, same type. I'm like, oh my gosh, that is me. When you say it that way, I get it. So sometimes that can be helpful too. Depending how deep you want to go, mostly what I like to do is make my leaders aware of this. You know, in a group context, I can't do as deep a work, but I want you to have it as a tool that you can start to bring into your daily life. And then we can bring into the coaching too, especially as you get more familiar with your type.
And that was under bonus module 2.
I think it's 3, yeah, maybe 2. Yeah, you may be right. It's 2, I think.
Your personal wire.
I can probably look it up here.
Enneagram type summary guide and find your. Yeah.
Okay. Yep. That's it. Okay, there's so much more we could talk about. I do a full day training when I do this, like in person for companies, but I just wanted you to have the high level exposure. Remember that whatever core type you are, you have the wings of either side. So you'll notice, like, if you're caught between two, it's often, and they're right next to each other, it's often because it's one is your wing, one is your primary type. And then you have connecting lines, which are like also a connection type. And those lines point you to where they connect. So I want you to think of yourself like a human being is. You've got a head, a trunk, that's your primary type. You've got an arm on each side, those are your wings. And you've got 2 legs, those are your connecting types. And what usually happens for us as we go through life is we have a tendency to be really good at 2 of those, maybe sometimes 3, and then we're really, really low in the other 2. So you'll often find that one of your wings and one of your connecting lines is the lowest score on the entire Enneagram. And it's because it's underdeveloped and it's the thing that's designed to create balance. So an example of that is, look at an 8 and a 9. The 8 is that hard charging. The 9 is the whale and the sloth. Like, you can see how that balances. The 8 is all about power and charging. The 7 is all about joy. You can see how that balances, right? So when you start getting access to your wing types, you become a more integrated person. And so, to use a sports metaphor, it's a little bit like every single play, I've got 5 players, but I keep putting the same 2 players on the field no matter what. Same 2 players, and I'm expecting to win every game. When you start getting access to all of your superstars and you start putting them in the game at different times, you're going to get different results and different outcomes. Okay. That was a little longer than I normally do, but this is deep work. And so I wanted to take the time. The agenda is yours. Who would like to talk? You can talk about the Enneagram, or you talk about anything else going on in work life.
I'm good. This is a discovery for me. We're still in discovery phases. And it's bringing up the awareness. It goes back to, I think the first conversation was, the skills that got you here are not going to get you there. So, and that, I'll be frank, it's opened up a, you know, it's turned the lights on basically in my mind. And things are getting a little easier, even though nothing's really changed. So like, you know, the bull, the rhino's not coming out as much. Let's put it that way. And no, there's a sense of ease. Like I can figure this out, you know, and go into the next phase of this thing. So anyway,
I love it. Mark, that's awesome to hear. And I love how you've taken this on. You've taken it really seriously. And in a really short period of time, you've gotten a lot of growth already. I will tell you that that's pretty natural of an eight. You may be an eight, because eights that I know, when they choose to actually do this work, they accelerate faster than most other types. They just have this kind of, now they're often the hardest to get to do this kind of work. They tend to resist it the most. They tend to be the most suspicious. But once they decide, they go fast. So that may be you.
You were starting to talk about a second resource you were to take to the chat window. And then we kind of pulled you off in another direction. I didn't want to miss out on that if there was another resource you wanted to put in there.
You're right. I had that very thought too, and I can't remember what it was.
It might be the books.
Oh, it was the books, and I realized that the books I recommend are actually in the 9-page PDF that you can get access to. And I would just say, you know, download one of those books, dig into a couple of key types, and just get familiar with it, and start to notice and see, and ask your spouse, you know, or whoever you're with, like, what do you see? This is kind of what I'm seeing. Does that seem right to you? And then feel free to email me whatever results you get. I'd love to know what types you're coming up with.
I've taken this, I've taken the free test before and things like that. I don't remember what my result was, but, I've also, what is the other, the 16 Myers-Briggs or whatever?
Yep.
I've done that one quite a bit, but have been becoming more familiar with the Enneagram types. And yeah, I mean, I already said while you were going through it, I mean, it just was like so clear to me that I'm a one. But I think it's really understanding, you know, the wing and what I am not familiar with the, what do you say, the lines, whatever, the other connection points. I don't know what that would be. So I'm curious to dig into that more.
Do you want me to share a little bit about being a one and the connection types?
Sure. Yeah, that'd be great.
So this'll show you also areas where you feel maybe you're the types are underrepresented or underfunctioning in you. Mm-hmm. So you probably have a whole lot of one and two going on in you. Mm-hmm. You're a helper type, I think. You got a lot of like, let me help out. You do it through the lens of a one, which is I'm going to help in the right way. And that's part of the reason why ones live with a great deal of stress. They because they can carry so much weight, they tend to load themselves up. And then they tend to be pretty hard on themselves for not doing it well enough. And so, you know, there's the two things that I'll often do when I'm coaching a one is I'll be like, let's go get a beer and have ribs. If that's something that one really loves, let's say, like I did this not long ago with a one who's really loves craft beer and ribs. And for his coaching session, I said, we're going to go get whatever beer you like and ribs. And we're not going to talk about work or how to optimize you at all. And it was the most painful coaching session he had ever had. Because he was just like, so unproductive and inefficient. And so like, and I'm like, your only objective is that at the end of that session, On a scale of 1 to 10, your joy meter should be close enough to a 5 that you should be feeling some measurable joy. So that's the goal, is that you can do something pleasure filled that creates joy. Now, what I was activating was the 7 connection for him, because ones become so totalitarian with themselves. Even their vacations are a form of work. They have to optimize their vacations even. They don't even know how to be irresponsible and relaxed. Whereas a 7 is just about joy. And what happens is when you begin to infuse a 1 with that kind of joy, they go easier on themselves and others, and they become more relaxed and more effective. And so it's just, it's not true for everybody, right? I'm just giving you one example so that you can start thinking about, you know, the reflection questions for sure in that document are going to help all of you. Once you figure out the type you think you might be, start asking yourself those questions. One of the questions for the 1 is, on a scale of 1 to 10, what is my level of self-criticism today? You know,
it's like a 10 every day.
Yes. That's right? How you know you're a 1. Yeah. If you ask a 7 that question, they'd be like, self-criticism? What? Why? What a giant waste of time. Whereas for a 1, they're like, is there any other way of being? So those reflection questions are super helpful. Now, here's what's really hard for a 1. The most important thing is for you not to judge the answer. So if you say it's a level 10 and you go, it's a level 10, it's a level 10. I do not want you going, gosh, I'm doing it wrong. I need to get it down to a 9. That is not the goal. The goal is awareness, period, full stop, without judgment. And here's an amazing thing that starts to happen. When you are identified with your pattern, you are locked in and you are a slave to it. You have no capacity to transcend it because you're locked into it. Awareness does this. It releases and creates just a tiny infinitesimal gap. Just this much of a gap allows for freedom of choice. Now you're free from the prison.
Yeah, like the idea is just saying like, okay, you know, for example, what I was talking about at the start of the call, where I was judging myself for the, you know, what happened with this particular employee. The idea is to step back and say, oh, interesting. I'm really critical of myself in how I handled that situation. I wonder why I'm being so critical of myself. Like, what is, and kind of like dig deeper into why I'm feeling that way and understand it better, but not automatically jump to any kind of conclusion about it. Is that the right way to think about it?
Yep. That's correct. And no need to correct your behavior even. Keep doing it if you want.
Just observe.
That's the other thing. You just go, I just noticed that I'm really critical. I'm at a level 10 of criticism. I'm one of the best criticizers on the planet. I'm really good at criticizing myself. I'm the best. You know, you can reframe it if you need to so that you can relax enough to see it. And the more you see it, the more it starts to show up. All you're doing is this.
Yeah.
You're getting a tiny, tiny little bit of gap. And that's a muscle you exercise over time. And here are the stages of self-awareness. Stage 1 is, I act out in a certain way and somebody else has to come and tell me that that happened and I'm defensive. And then a month later, I go, you know what? On reflection, they're probably right. That's stage 1 of self-awareness. Super useful. Stage 2 of self-awareness is somebody comes and says, hey, you did this thing wrong. And I go, you're probably right. I did that thing wrong. Stage 3 of self-awareness is nobody tells you. A month later, you go, gosh, I think I did that wrong. And stage 4 of self-awareness is in the moment, as it's unfolding, you are noticing the pattern. You don't have to change it. You don't have to judge it. You're just seeing it unfold. And that is a very, very advanced stage of self-awareness. When you are in the moment aware and able to name the energetic shifts that are occurring in you, because when you can do that live, you now have the maximum amount of choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You will have choice at every stage of self-awareness, but the greatest and maximum amount of choice is the in the moment awareness where you're like, I'm super activated right now. I'm really angry. Right now, I'm really angry. And I'm noticing that.
Yeah. Or
right now, I'm noticing that I'm super, super critical in this moment. It's happening. I'm very critical of this person I'm talking to. That is the work of the Enneagram at the heart of it. So yeah. I don't want you to figure out anything else for all of you, just that one technique over and over again throughout your days. And you will relax.
That is really interesting. So it's really interesting because I'm kind of connecting a dot with something else that I've been reading. I don't know where the book went. I'm a mom. I have a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old. Shane, I think you and I talked about this, but just for everyone else. And I am being a one, I am, you know, really, I am researching parenting to death so I can do it perfectly.
Yes, you are. And clearly not doing it right yet. There's so many ways you're
right. Yeah, pretty much. I'm the best mom, but I'm also like the worst mom, and yep. I could be doing so much better. But there's a person who I just absolutely love. Her name is Rebecca Kennedy, and she goes by Dr. Becky. And she's basically like a child psychologist and helps families and has her own private practice. But then she's also, you know, like creating a community for parents. And she just puts out the most mind-blowing content about like how to reparent yourself and like repair the damage that your parents did when they were raising you, and how to break the generational cycles to, you know, like raise better kids who are more emotionally regulated and all that kind of stuff. And it is carrying over into my work world where, you know, if my kid is having a tantrum, I'm like, hey, it's not about me. I can just be calm and I can see how I'm reacting to my kid in this moment. And here's a reaction that is going to, you know, exacerbate the problem. And here's a reaction that's actually going to help the problem. And then I literally just take the same thinking and apply it, you know, to adult relationships. And it's actually really effective. And it aligns really interestingly with what you've gone over today in the Enneagram. So, yeah.
Sounds like a force greater than you is working on you. Synchronistically bringing together the kind of messaging and resourcing you need.
Yes.
Yes. I love it. Well, I'm
timing on everything is interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, I love it. I think it's beautiful. And I think you're absolutely right. I can't imagine anything harder in the world than being a mother one in this day and age. The amount of neurosis that we have around parenting is just extraordinary. When, you know, Aboriginal people didn't need help raising kids. They figured out you need to love them really a lot early on and make sure you help them learn to regulate their system. And that just means some contact. And, you know, it's not complicated stuff. And the other thing we learned is humans are unbelievably resilient and very capable of bouncing back from just about anything that we could throw at them. So, I think we could all be served by bringing down the level of demand.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times people need to be treated like kids and kids need to be treated like people.
Totally agree.
I was going to say a good exercise, a good tool is just work with the framework that you got a bunch of third graders. You know, if you think in terms of that, we're all just big babies anyway, you know.
Yeah. Rogers had an amazing wisdom related to adults. You know, when somebody asked him what he thought of Donald Trump, and he said, you know, who would be like the antithesis of Mr. Rogers? And Mr. Rogers said, Donald Trump was a child at one time too. And he wanted to be loved and heard just like all of us. And it was this remarkable like de-escalation that I wouldn't have expected, but I was quite moved by. I was like, wow, what would that be like to appreciate that we all have an inner little boy and an inner little girl that never really goes away. And so in a lot of ways, what I'm doing when I'm talking about the Enneagram is I'm actually speaking to your inner child in a sense and saying, don't judge it. Just bring your child into the lap and ask it questions. What's going on? What are you feeling now? What's happening now?
Yeah.
Pissed off. Yeah. What are you pissed off about? Okay. I'm anxious. All right. You're anxious. What are you anxious about?
So I used to trade the market, and this may be helpful just in talking about this. And one of the tools, because trading is 100% emotion. It's, I mean, analytical, you could think it through, but the minute you're at risk, all the emotions flare. And one of the tools was basically the silent observer, a non-judgmental observer, to watch where your energy is in your body. I don't know if that resonates, but you can see if you're angry, where is it? And just watch it with an observation, and you'll find out it's kind of irrational, you know? So I think that kind of goes, I haven't done it in a long time. I should, Tony, now that we're
talking. Where did you mentioned where that came from. Where did that come from?
I ran a hedge fund. I was a trader. I can't remember. Maybe a book I read. And I used to use the techniques to calm myself based on my logic. Things would happen and would throw my logic out the window. Fear, greed, you know, anxiety, euphoria, you know. And a good trader is not, you're emotional because you're human, but it's not deciding or doing things on those particular things. All it did was, I think it, what you're talking about is develop the gap so you get back to your logic.
That's exactly how. Right. Well, it certainly reflects a dear friend of mine who mentored me and actually ended up in this very program, a guy named Tim Galway, and he wrote a book called The Inner Game of Tennis. And it's actually a book Tom Brady says is the best sports psychology book he's ever read. It was written in the 70s. And it's very reminiscent of the things you're saying. So I'd be curious if it were the same book. But anyway, yes, you're absolutely right. That's an awareness practice. So another piece of work we do is body awareness. So emotion is just energy in motion. And when you have whatever that emotion is, if you can turn emotion, which is experienced as time, and you turn it into space, it becomes an object instead of a subject, and you have the ability to move it instead of it moving you. So for example, most people will say, I was angry for an hour or 3 days. We only understand it in time, which is one half dimension, and it's subjective. But if you could stop for a moment and I could guide you through an exercise and I could see, where is it in your body? It's in my chest. Okay. How big is it? It's the size of a basketball. Is it hard or is it soft? It's hard. Is it moving or is it still? It's moving. What color is it? It's red. So it's a moving red basketball in the center of your chest. Yes. Now you have captured something that was time and turned it into space. And because we've objectified it repeatedly, that anger now, even if the anger doesn't change, is now an object that you have some ability to manually deal with. And so that's another piece of work that's related to this, that's a little more slightly different. But I think it speaks to what you're talking about.
That was some of the deeper principles behind that. It was, you know, actually it was how to get it to dissipate. And by just the mere observation and the studying of it with a non-judgmental mentality, it would dissipate. And, you know, I think that's it. What you're saying is you objectify it and it's a thing now versus you. Right.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's what this is. When you go like this, it's now a thing. Right. For the first time ever, criticism, self-criticism becomes a thing, an object, not who I am, for sure. This is great. You guys are really doing great work. Super, super excited. Good. What else? We've got a few more minutes. Anything else?
It's funny how these things are, I call them Dr. Phil sessions, but, you know, business is 100% emotion. It's just like trading. I'm in this project to get my business bigger, right? But it seems like we always go down to the self and what's going on here versus everywhere else. It's beneficial. So it's good.
Well, I think once you're elevated and you're leading people, you have to connect with them on an emotional level because you can't possibly be there with them in everything that they're doing, right? You have to guide their emotions and their own judgment when they can't necessarily connect with themselves on it, I think is just the challenge. I liked your third grader analogy, basically. Like, it's totally that. It's just guiding people in their lives.
And Mark, to your comment of wanting to make your business bigger, something I'm also working on here, and that has to do with people sometimes forget that everything we're doing is sales. We are always selling. We're selling something to somebody. And what do people buy? People buy relationships. They don't just buy products. They buy products from people that they feel a connection to. And that awareness of who we are and who we're dealing with really will help a lot in making those sales and making things grow and improving the relationship with the customer.
Yeah, it's an excellent point. It's true. Because I mean, you know, processes change and everything. I think I've got a package of motivation and leadership qualities that are really just kind of one size. Well, it's not even one size fits all. It's the only ones I know and the only ones I use. And everybody else is needs, you know, from this, they need different things. So that's where kind of where my development needs to be is this person needs that, that person needs that, and utilize just whatever intentions behind it, but do it more effectively for them. So
actually, I have a question then related, Shane, you said earlier, you know, don't try to type other people. Is that just when you're working with them in the moment and like pointing out their type, or is it like, you know, I'm working with my team and I'm like, I think they're a six. How do I support a six? Would you recommend that? Or do you actually recommend like going through the motions with them and having them take a test and like literally talking about the Enneagram before you do anything with it?
Yeah. So I would say, what I'm trying to avoid it. First of all, privately, you're going to type everybody you meet now. Once you understand this, you're going to be typing all the time. That's fine. Playfully, as long as there's good humor and goodwill both ways, playfully typing happens all the time. Like, oh, there goes the nine again, you know, and everybody's laughing and we know we're joking. But you, what I want to avoid is people going, Shane, you need to stop being such a three right now.
Yeah,
it's a way to invalidate and undermine their comments by using something that's actually quite exposing. And so it's a tool that can be like weaponized and misused and abused. Unlike most other tools, by the way, the Enneagram is one of the most powerful and therefore can be weaponized. And that's why typically I don't recommend you just roll it out to your whole company and hope for the best, whereas you can with StrengthsFinder or DISC or any of these others. Or next week, I'm going to introduce you to one that I developed called the Five Leadership Languages. That one you can just roll out. And I did that because I kept running into the same problem with the Enneagram, which is it's super good when it's targeted and in smaller groups and I have some ability to navigate it. I needed something that was less deep and effective still that also hit as many people as you wanted without any trouble. So we'll talk about that next week. But yeah, the goal is to say, just don't type them as a way to try to direct them or control them or whatever. You would simply put yourself in front of them. That's very powerful. So when you acknowledge to others, hey, my number, whatever that number is, my one is kind of overactive right now. And I just need you guys to bear with me while I get super kind of tedious and, you know, playful. People will immediately forgive it. And that's why the other thing I tell people is compassion and humor. Those are the two things you most need if you're going to work with the Enneagram. A good sense of humor with yourself and a lot of compassion for others and yourself.
I can see a big risk with the Enneagram too. And that is if you believe somebody is something and you get interacting with them as if they are that and they're not that, you could cause totally create problems for yourself too.
Yeah,
absolutely.
What about I know so where I think it could be effective is this: everybody knows how everybody sees themselves. I mean, if I've got a group of I think I've got seven kind of, you know, to high level leadership, we did it and discussed it in a room. I think everybody, I mean, including myself, I mean, I want to know about myself, but I want my director of HR to know how to better deal with me communicate or interact.
And so that's why that 9-page summary is so helpful. You can hand that out to them. And so for sure it can be used like at that level, I do it. No problem. Have people take the test and get together and discuss what their type were and all that kind of fun stuff. I would just what's that?
I said good because I just bought them and they're going to get them pretty soon here. So I bought all the tests.
I think that's great. So the next thing then is to make sure that you frame it and you're the emotional leader. So you're going to say, hey, everybody, couple of rules. One, we're not going to use this to bludgeon each other. We're going to use this to serve each other. Second is all of us are encouraged, including me, to type ourselves in front of each other. And third is compassion and humor when we talk about this stuff.
Yeah.
And then you have to model that. You've got to have that playfulness.
Yeah.
And you will. You'll be easy at it. And that'll set the tone and you will see changes.
Okay.
All right, everybody.
I'm not going to wing it, but yeah, it's, I'm going to work on it. I got to know it first, but I think it'd be good. I mean, because we've got all these other projects that we're dealing with. So anyway, thank you.
You can use it as you're interviewing new candidates. I wouldn't use it as a criterion for exclusion. So I would never say, don't hire an 8 if you've already got an 8. It's not like that. You're looking for high functioning. How high functioning are they? Awesome. Well, thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Doug, we'll see you in a couple months. I know this was just sort of a bonus call for you, and we'll get you started in a couple months. But looking forward to you joining us.
Excellent. Nice to see everybody. Have a great evening. We'll talk to you soon.
Enjoy your holiday.
Next week, I am doing a call. I understand if nobody's around, it's Thanksgiving week, but I'll be available next Wednesday for those that want to chat.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Bye.